This is Crossroads, the Get Religion podcast.
What we know about churches and the pandemic is what's happening now. That's all the more we can know. We know what's happened in the past and what's happening now. Predicting the future is very difficult, but there are people who research such things, and their predictions, based upon what they're hearing from churches on the ground, do not sound good. At least according to the Barna Group, there are churches, one in five churches, that anticipate closing their doors post-COVID. Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Will it be a big story if 20 to 30% of American religious congregations close their doors for good post-COVID?
That's almost funny to state that. Let's state it another way. What if COVID closed 20 to 30% of American colleges and universities? Would that cause any big issues?
Most certainly.
How about 20 to 30% of college football teams?
Definitely.
I mean, my point here is this is one of those subjects that's so huge, you could spend all day just talking about the dozens of stories that would grow out of this. And one of the main things to me is that people need to realize that this is perhaps the ultimate local, regional, national story that we could be looking at in the next 12 to 18 months. If David Kinnaman and the veteran analyst at the Barna Group, if they're right about this. I wrote the column that I wrote this week, the On Religion column, you know, for the Universal Syndicate. I wrote the column because, quite frankly, I'd seen chatter about this quote from Kinnaman in social media, but I'm not seeing that many stories about the coronavirus crisis and where it could put us, other than just kind of people talking about, you know, the impact of online technology for worship services. And then there's been some incredible reporting about pastors, you know, the stress on pastors and especially people trying to relate to funerals and hospital ministries and what's happened to weddings. You've seen some local coverage about things like that, but we haven't had anybody kind of zoom up to airline flight altitude and look down on this thing and recognize the size of some of the stories that could come out of this.
Another thing that Kinnaman notes in that research for Barna is that for your kind of average house of worship, it may be one in five. For mainline churches, it might be one in three.
Oh, well, you know, we've already had in recent years people beginning to calculate when some of the Seven Sisters denominations will vanish. At their current rates, you vector in the rate of their decline, then you factor in astonishingly low birth rates and declining numbers of marriages and lack of evangelism that wins any new members. You might remember, I think you and I discussed it maybe a year ago, a column that I wrote about someone who calculated and decided that the Anglican Church of Canada will be gone in like 15 years, something like that, 15, maybe 20. I've seen similar people calculations for several other mainline bodies. And for people who are wondering what we're talking about here, this is that group that frequently gets called the Seven Sisters by sociologists. And if you take those in descending order by size, and as I say this, you can probably hear some potential news stories go by. First of all, the United Methodist Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church, the American Baptist Churches USA, the United Church of Christ, and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. Now, right at the very top of that one, did you hear the big potential story?
You mean with regard to the United Methodist Church?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing that popped into my mind was that they are shrinking here but growing abroad.
Exactly. But also, you're going to have, in the midst of this crisis and in the midst of decline, I mean, Methodist churches that I drive by here in East Tennessee, which is a very United Methodist intensive area, I don't think they've had any worship services yet. They're trying to survive totally online, yet many of them have demographics that are going quite elderly. So there's that factor again. But they're going to face voting at the local level, winner-take-all voting, on which of the two competing Methodist churches that are going to emerge in the next year or so, growing out of the split over their book of discipline related to teachings on marriage and sexuality. You're going to have one church that defends the ancient teachings of the church, and that's primarily a global South church, and then maybe 30 to 40% of the American churches. Some people put that as low as 25, but a significant number. And then most other people are going to join a church that is going to evolve and at the very least make it to where local churches get to make up their own mind what Christianity teaches about marriage and sexuality. And then some people think there will be a third liberal church, primarily in the West and the Northeast, that will make it mandatory that you have to embrace liberal modernized doctrines. You know, so you've got liberal required. In the middle, you have local option. Christian doctrine varies from zip code to zip code. And then on the doctrinal right, you have a conservative church that goes along with the rest of global Methodism, or most of global Methodism, specifically in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, in defending centuries of small O Christian orthodoxy. Well, that was going to blow a lot of churches sky high anyway. Some people have been saying that when you split some of these churches, you're not going to have enough people in either of those groups to keep a church alive, let alone pay for clergy. Now, on top of that, you throw in the coronavirus crisis, and you throw in the United Methodists, and here comes another big story. There are parts of the United States where there are United Methodist churches all over the place at the level of rural and small towns, especially across the Sun Belt and up into the Midwest, heavy belt of United Methodist life. Well, we were facing struggles to keep churches alive in rural areas and small towns, especially mainline churches. Now I think you're going to be able to see that all denominations are going to be struggling to keep churches alive in those endangered financial areas of American life. Then here comes another one, and I'm just going to connect the dots here with you for a second. Another place you have lots of endangered mainline churches are in big, huge American cities. And some of those cities are not faring too well, to say the least, you know, in terms of the coronavirus crisis. Everybody talks about New York, but we're also talking about LA and obviously Minneapolis and Chicago and other cities. Well, in all of those downtowns, you have extremely expensive real estate with old, pricey buildings sitting on them, many of them in need of tremendous amount of maintenance, with shrinking elderly congregations. Well, can you imagine the real estate that's going to go up for grabs in downtown New York when some of these churches start closing? You can do that with Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church, obviously, and several other. So there we've got a real estate story, we've got a rural story, we've got an urban story. We can just stack these things up in layers, how this will affect the news and potential news stories.
I want to add in kind of a wrinkle there, and that is, from the very beginning of COVID, the the various Roman Catholic dioceses across the United States were kind of first adopters when it comes to let's just shut down and not try and do anything in person. And they've been pretty consistent about that, especially in blue states and in blue-run cities. And I suspect they've been able to buck the trend of, well, we're going to be able to reopen someday because perhaps those dioceses have a lot of money in the bank and enormous amounts of assets that they could draw upon to keep parishes open. That sounds like another huge story.
Well, I think the way I would state that, because I'm a member of a church that has the Eastern Orthodox bishops, have been very explicit, but a lot of those churches didn't so much close their doors as they very strictly obeyed what their local government authorities were asking them to do. And frequently they did that. I mean, for example, my own bishop here in the Diocese of the South of the Orthodox Church in America, he made it very explicit that he was going to protect his clergy. He was not going to let people attack their local priest because the priest either closed or they didn't close or they closed halfway, or there's going to be people who get mad no matter what you do. And our bishop basically said, our archbishop said, okay, guys, shoot at me. I'm going to make this decision. This is a matter of obedience for my priests. Stop bothering your priests. Well, I mean, so like my own church, I haven't missed church in quite a few weeks, but we're signing up to go to church and we're doing an occupancy of the building. We can have worship attendance based on what the local rates of COVID-19 infections and cases are. And some of us will take a week off every once in a while, and others will go. Or for a while, we had two services every weekend so that more people could go. So we're having what I would call COVID-19-shaped worship. We have a new normal. We don't have a choir, but we have four singers who sing at the very front of the church, and they face toward the altar so that they're not singing at anyone else. And everybody else is 10 feet apart. Now, so we're doing okay. And I think it's crucial to note that David Kinnaman, in the column that I wrote, he said, we're hearing from a lot of churches that are hanging in there. Then we hear a lot of others that it is week to week. So remember, when he says that he thinks 20% will close, he's saying that 80% won't close. And you've also got the fact that some people really hate online worship. And this is especially true in sacramental churches. Aren't you hearing that from your own people?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this just isn't cutting it in a church with sacraments that are at the heart of community life and faith. You throw in the difficulty of confession and a whole lot of other things that we've seen in ancient church traditions. Okay, so you've got people that really don't like online worship, and they're going to flock back into the church. But wait, those vaccines are not going to be available everywhere all at once, and they're not going to affect America instantaneously and consistently. So you're still going to have lots of high-risk older people. I'm 66 and have asthma. I'm very definitely high-risk, so I'm being very careful. But I am going back to church because I'm in a church that is really practicing social distancing. They're being very careful. Well, what if you were an older evangelical and your church decides in some Sunbelt state, your independent megachurch just says, hey, back to normal. Everybody come on down. Kinnaman thinks that a lot of elderly people are still going to be sitting there going, what in the world? I can't afford to go back. So then you're going to have churches that want to return to normal. Then you're going to have churches that completely, totally embrace the world of screens and online culture. I was reading a Southern Baptist story the other day. It was quoting a pastor that said, from now on, we're going to have our main campus, we're going to have our branch campus, and we're going to have an online campus. And we're thinking that for the rest of the life of our church, there will be hundreds of people who never walk in the doors. Now, that's a theology that works way better for people, pardon me if I show my prejudice here, for people who define worship as a really good sermon in a rock band. That goes onto the screens way better than Holy Sacrament, confession, Holy Week, all of the elaborate rituals of traditional and ancient Christianity. You know, so there's another story. The emergence of churches that completely embrace the whole idea that we may have people in our church who binge church once a month. And I may have to plan sermon series with the idea that someone may watch these services back to back, or they may worship shift. They watch Monday night football on Monday night. There's no football on Tuesday night, so church is going to go to Tuesday night. So they're going to worship shift using their technology. They're going to move church to Tuesday night, even though we're going to continue to record it on Sunday morning. How many pastors do you think are really going to warm up to that? And is that the same church? Are they a part of the same church as the people that go on Sunday morning? Are their children going to be as faithful in church? Are they going to tithe and donate of their time and money to church projects? This whole world of omnipresent screens, at some point you have to ask, can you create disciples of Christ through a digital screen? What's the evidence that that's possible? There's another story. I could go on and on.
So, Terry, I want to stay with the online concept just a little bit more, because there are things that can't be done online. You had mentioned them, the sacraments of the church. One might attempt confession online, I suppose, but, and there will be those who attempt that. Then there are things, the hands-on of pastoral ministry, that, in my mind, require presence. I'm thinking about burying the dead, but that doesn't mean someone isn't going to try and do it virtually.
Well, right now, they're having to do it in smaller rites. You know, weddings are being affected. Funerals, obviously, are being affected. A lot of pastoral ministry in hospitals are being affected. But I don't think we can predict what the future would look like, except we could say that it will look more like entertainment culture online. What do I mean when I say that? Among the Orthodox last year, we had to go through Holy Week without the ability to have Holy Week services. And I will admit that quite a few Orthodox people shipped around and said, well, is your church going to be able to stream this service? And some of us would say, no, that's not one of the ones our bishop is saying that we should attempt. And then they would write back and say, okay, here's the links to three monasteries that are going to have that service. I hear this one's got a really good choir. Okay, now that was very helpful and it was wonderful. But do you hear some of the consumer culture potential in that, especially in the world of Protestant megachurches? What if someone is like, oh, I watch my old local church every once in a while, but man, I really like that preacher over in North Carolina who's got that mega church and they've got the baptismal font where the people slide down the ramp into it with a splash, and that's just really cool. I'm going to start watching them too. Or maybe I'll save them and binge them every other week and send them part of my tithe. Or, I mean, can you see what I'm getting at here? Think of it as a religious version of, well, I've got Amazon Prime. I had Netflix up until the Cuties scandal. I've got Hulu. I've got whatever the heck this new NBC thing is. I've got YouTube TV. I can literally see a consumer culture, especially in the world of evangelical megachurch Protestantism, non-denominational faith. I can see people really just kind of going, well, you know, I feel like watching these guys tonight. They got a really good band. I could see that happening. because I know people who are already doing that. Well, what happens when you start losing some local churches? And the whole world of independent, non-denominational Protestantism, frankly, it doesn't have a lot of supervision and rules anyway. Kinnaman told me I wasn't able to get this column, this particular quote into my column. He said, in the world of megachurch Christianity, there's more fragility out there than you would imagine. Churches that may look like they're big and they've built this big church, you may not realize what percentage of their offerings are coming from people over the age of 50 or 60. And they're kind of waiting for the millennials and others to kick in and grow up and become normal church members. Well, what if they never become normal church members now? What happens to a lot of those big, huge, expensive megachurch buildings? We don't know. We don't know. But Barna and several other people are starting to investigate and research the financial impact of some of these patterns, as well as church attendance. You're hearing people say, well, I've got about 30 to 40% of my people are coming back to church now. Maybe we'll have more, but as Kinnaman told me, he said, when the COVID thing first hit, we were hearing people say, high 70s to low 80s of pastors were saying, I am absolutely sure that my church is going to be fine. That figure, he said, now is in the middle to high 50s in terms of pastors who are absolutely sure. And one of the things that's going on is the simple fact of the matter. There are a lot of older pastors out there. The baby boom generation was huge. And there are a lot of pastors, let's say 55 and up, who may not be as online culture friendly. So how many of those pastors are we going to lose? In addition to their church, how many of those pastors are going to find themselves stranded? And in independent churches, they may not have retirement plans. They may not have medical plans. And I'm beginning to hear a lot of chatter about stressed out pastors who just really aren't sure how long they can do what it takes to run a virtual church and try to run a real church at the same time.
I think that's kind of what, and I'm thinking about this from the terms of the parish where my wife and I attend, where it's a small-sized parish. It is in a small town. Probably most people call it rural. And giving has been up since COVID, but people have kind of been stepping up. But everybody knows that's probably not going to last forever. And well, if you're still running at 40% capacity on Sunday morning, you got to think about the long term. And you got to think about, can I continue to put the effort in that it takes to do this online thing, which everybody seems to love, and then do the in-person thing? And no man, I think somebody once said, no man can serve two masters.
Well, the other thing there is that word discipleship. I think those people that are out there that are still giving and are still doing everything they can to help and support their pastors, I think we would be willing to say that a high percentage of them are good disciples. Their faith is really affecting all of their life. It's something they take into account in whatever they do. But is that becoming the American norm with the growth of the religiously unaffiliated? One of the things I mentioned in my column, I made a quick reference to this recent State of Theology study by Lifeway Research, in which they found that 52% of Americans affirmed that Jesus was a great teacher, but not God. Then we had 48% of Americans said that the Bible is 100% accurate and trustworthy. 48's a lot. But that's the exact same percentage as those who believe that all books of Scripture are basically helpful ancient myths and shouldn't be considered true. Well, do we think that in an age of competing screens and voices and entertainment, the percentage of people who are highly discipled and disciplined about their faith is going to go up or down based on, right now, loyalty to the NFL is at risk? And that's a thought that was about as enthusiastic a religion as we have. At the end of my column, there's a quote from Kinnaman that I'd like to read that I think sums up some, Todd, of what you just said. There is no question that social media has great power in the lives of young people. The idea is whether that's enough to get them through all the challenges they will face in life. What will happen when all of these digital screens and social media platforms stop serving as tools that we use and then turn into the foundations of how we live our lives? How does that affect what the church is and what it does? I thought that was a very haunting question. It's one thing to say social media is something that helps us. We do the occasional event online. It's another thing to say, I am the pastor of a flock that now functionally defines its life according to what they are consuming through smartphones, tablets, and computers. And they're time shifting all of this to whenever it fits their schedules best. And I don't know when I'll hear from them, except all of a sudden their teenager is in trouble and they need help. And you're in the position of saying, who are you? I mean, you have to go into your role and search and find out if they're even in the role. And they say, no, but I watch your shows. Lots of questions. And if I may say so bluntly, lots of potential news stories.
And I think, Terry, here with the just about a minute or so, because it's online, it also means it's illocal. And that means someone calls me and says, I'm a pastor. He says, hey, I'm having trouble with my teenager. I need some help. Okay. Give me your address. And it turns out they live across the country.
Yeah.
And I can't go help them with their teenager. And yeah. I've gotten myself into a situation that did not need to happen.
Or you're saying, well, I can tell you to watch this, but you're going to do exactly this. You're going to call up online and you're going to try to find out where there's a local church that can put some flesh on this crisis, in the sense that sacraments are God using real things in the real world. And you need somebody to get to them, right?
Right.
Someone who can look them in the face, hear their voice, and can help them. And if you take away 30% of those churches, 20% more down the road, at some point, glowing digital screens are not going to be enough.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. And he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a production of Get Religion, part of the First Amendment Projects at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. If you appreciate this podcast, please make a secure, online, tax-deductible donation at getreligion.org.